Call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division to order for Thursday, March 20th. A couple of housekeeping items. We're close on a target, but it's not ready to be made public yet, so I'm not going to say anything about that. But we do now understand our deadlines a little bit better. I know that the first, second, and third deadlines have been published, but third deadline is what it takes to get a finance bill actually out of the full finance committee. In the Senate, we are a division, and so we have to have an article constructed to send over to Dick Cohen's full finance committee, and we have to have that article out of this division by end of the day on the 31st of March. These are very, very tight timelines. You can expect to be very busy in this committee as we start getting bills referred to us from full finance. Bills have to make it through all of the policy committees and get referred to the full finance committee, and then the authors need to make a hearing request before it will be sent down to our division to even hit our radar screen where we can schedule a hearing on it. So it's going to be, you know, we don't have a lot of bills to hear right now. They're still working. We're working at a very fast pace. There is no meeting tomorrow. There was an erroneous message that went out that there might be a meeting tomorrow night. I don't want people showing up and being upset. There is no meeting tomorrow at all, not during the day or the evening. And the the motion for things that might go into our article, I didn't have that ready when we heard our first budget bill. Our bills will be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus bill. Because in the second year of a biennium, we construct one finance bill that goes to the floor that has articles for each of the finance divisions. That's what's going on here. So, I mean, if members have questions or something, if I haven't been clear, I'm certainly happy to entertain those. Or you can talk to, you know, any of us privately about offline. That's fine, too. With that, we do have five bills to get through, and some of them might take a little discussion, so we'll get right in, and we'll go with Senator Wicklund, Senate File 2004. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I am here today to present Senate File 2004. This is a DHS bill, and it actually, the bill amends two riders that were enacted in the 2013 legislative session that were mistakenly enacted in a form that does not match the legislative tracking sheet for the omnibus HHS bill. So the proposed corrections are technical, and they're budget neutral. And I don't know, there's two different ones. Do you want me to just go over each or read over each one?
I think that maybe we can. These are technical corrections to what was the intent of the HHS omnibus bill last year. DHS asked us that we expedite this and get this heard. It would allow them the flexibility to use the funds in the way they were intended for adoption services programs.
Right. Corrected. One of them has to do with the adoption assistance base funding, and the other has to do with a grant for high-risk adults.
So we can probably get counsel to confirm that this is a technical correction to conform.
Mr. Chair, yes, they are technical.
Any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I had a constituent visiting in my office, and I don't know if this is a particular bill. I can't tell as much by this language, but it had to do with the CDCS grant program, federal grant program. This does not have to
this
do
is
with
not,
it.
This is not that one, Senator.
Does not have that in here. No. Okay.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moved Senate File 2004 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, right. Senator Whitman.
Thank you very much.
Senator Dibble, Senate File 2194.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 2194 is a subject that's been before this committee previously. It has to do with funding for the Homeless Youth Act. As you recall, members, this act was first passed in 2006 and established a process to provide funds for the continuum of services that have been proven effective in addressing youth homelessness. And we're talking, of course, about unaccompanied youth in this instance, whether it's from street outreach, drop-in centers, transitional housing, supportive housing, et cetera, folks who are at risk of homelessness and are actually homeless. Mr. Chair, members made a significant stride last year in providing $4 million for this purpose of an $8 million request. I'm happy to report that money actually is a little bit over. It's about $4.2 million. I'm happy to report that money was fully subscribed and is out doing incredible and amazing work, and we'll hear briefly from folks who can tell you more details about that. But there were $20 million in applications from 51 organizations statewide. Of those, $10 million was deemed ready to go, viable proposals that could have created a significant impact. It was 30 grantees who were awarded Homeless Youth Act dollars, most in order to get as many dollars out to as many organizations as possible. Folks were just given a portion of their request. And Mr. Chair, I would just request that the committee focus on what the long-term impact of these dollars are when kids are able to come into this kind of care, have contact with caring, supportive adults who take an interest in their lives, be put on a path of either reunification with their families or able to stabilize their own lives, go back to school, become healthy, transition into successful adulthood. The dividends are pretty incredible. We actually have metrics around those. Youth experience almost $12,000 annual increase in wages. We know that high school graduate lifetime earnings are significantly higher than dropouts. It's actually determined that there's a 4-to-1 return to the state for every dollar invested in Homeless Youth Act services. I want to be clear, this request wouldn't fully fund the identified need as I described, but this would definitely be another step in the right direction, and we would appreciate very much the committee's consideration. With that, I'll be going to you first.
Sure.
Susie Schatz here from Lutheran Social Services, who's been helping spearhead this effort over the last couple of years.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank
State
you.
State your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Susie Schatz. I'm from Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, and I'm also representing Youth Moving Forward, which is a coalition of statewide homeless youth services providers and advocates. And we've been working as Youth Moving Forward on the Homeless Youth Act with Senator Dibble since 2006. Thank you so much for the investment and the attention that you paid to homeless youth this last legislative session. And we're here to share a little new information and to ask for your support again. So briefly, the handouts you have in front of you, one is a list of the grants that were awarded. And as Senator Dibble noted, many applicants were either not funded at all or just a small portion of their request was funded. The second item that you have in front of you is the details about the request from last session, some key points about some new information from Wilder in our request this session. So today you're going to hear from Brian Pittman from Wilder Research and also Megan Bowman and Jennifer Erdman from Lakes and Pines Community Action. They're going to talk about what we know about homeless youth from the most recent survey and about the challenging circumstances for homeless youth in greater Minnesota specifically. So.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Lurie, committee members, and staff. I'm happy at the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Brian Pittman, and I'm one of the researchers who is responsible for conducting the statewide study of homelessness every 3 years in Minnesota. I'm representing Wilder Research today, which is distinct from the program and policy arms of the Wilder Foundation. The statewide study of homelessness is now in its eighth cycle. Data was last collected in October of 2012, and study data includes both single-night counts of individuals staying in shelters and other time-limited housing programs, as well as information from a face-to-face survey of nearly one-half of the people staying in those programs and outside of those programs. This work in 2012 was carried out by 1,200 volunteer interviewers across the state of Minnesota, and it happened at 350 different locations, including outreach locations across the state and places not intended for habitation. A few key facts from the survey. The study counted a total of 10,214 homeless people who were homeless on the night of October 25th, 2012. This represents about a 6% increase from the 2009 study. Of this number, 1,151 were young people 21 years of age or younger, and 150 were unaccompanied minors under 18. An additional 3,546 were children under the age of 18 who were accompanying their homeless parents. We know that this number of 1,151 youth and young adults who are on their own experiencing homelessness is an undercount. In fact, we know that the homeless youth population is the most difficult to find and count. There are a couple key reasons for this. One is there are fewer emergency shelter beds available to homeless youth. Homeless youth are also more likely to seek shelter from a friend or another family. And finally, there are, homeless youth are often exploited or exposed to violence, and many have traumatic experiences in their background. Despite this, we've made an attempt to estimate the total number of homeless youth in the state of Minnesota on any single given night, and the number we calculated for 2012 is around 4,000. The estimating procedures that we used have been updated since our 2009 survey. We're now using an estimation that's based more on population incident estimates combined with our survey data instead of using multiplier factors based on our shelter counts that we do as part of the study. Previous estimating methods were found to have significantly undercounted the homeless youth population. So this change has helped us better account for more of the homeless youth population that may be hidden or out of sight, and particularly those not connected to formal services. I'd like to share an additional few facts about homeless youth for your consideration. When we look at the entire group of those 21 or younger, the typical age of entry into homelessness is 17 years old. For those under 18, it's 15. And then when we look at the entire homeless population that we've included in our survey, that includes adults and youth, the most common entry ages into homelessness are 16, 17, and 18 years old. Roughly 54% of all homeless youth in the Twin Cities and 65% of homeless youth in Greater Minnesota have been in some type of out-of-home care. This includes about 40% who spent some time in foster care. 60% of all homeless youth have had at least one parent who has been incarcerated. Half of homeless youth have severe or persistent mental health issues. 44% of homeless youth have been physically abused as children, 27% have been sexually abused, and 31% have been neglected. And if you take all three of those, about half of the homeless youth population has experienced one of those types of maltreatment. Significant racial disparities also exist in the homeless youth population. Approximately half of all homeless youth in the metro area are African American, and about 1 in 5 in Greater Minnesota are American Indian. Most of our homeless youth population are homegrown. In fact, 76% of the homeless youth population grew up in Minnesota. 15% of the homeless youth identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or unsure of their sexual identity, and 2% identify as transgender. Overall, 29% of homeless youth are parents themselves. This includes 39% of homeless female youth who are parents. And finally, nearly one quarter of youth show evidence of traumatic brain injury. But despite all of these factors and stats that I've just stated, these homeless youth are shown to be incredibly resistant. In fact, most are still enrolled in school. That includes 95% of minors of school age. And 7 out of 10 did attend school on the day of the survey. Among those homeless youth who are 19 and older, 50% had already completed high school. And also 31% of homeless youth have some type of employment at the time of the interview, and this is actually higher than the adult homeless population. All of this, of course, represents simply the statistics and the numbers that frame this issue and not the faces and stories of the youth themselves. But I thank you for your attention that you're giving to this matter, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Pittman. Any questions of members? If not, we can move to the two from Lakes and Pines. Jennifer Erdman, and then you had one other name that's not on my list. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Jennifer Erdman from Lakes and Pines. Our office is based out of Mora, and we serve seven counties: Aiken, Carlton, Pine, Mille Lacs, Kennebec, Chisago, and Isanto counties. And what I'd like to we're fortunate recipients of the HYA grant. We received funding to implement a host home program as well as provide some transitional housing for homeless youth. I guess what I'd like to say is that within our service area, we have zero shelter beds for homeless youth, very limited resources for the homeless youth population, so any amount of funding is definitely a benefit for our communities. I'd also like to introduce you with Megan Bowman, and she'll share some information about some of the youth that we are serving.
Ms. Bowman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and Mr. and Committee. My name is Megan Bowman, and I work as a community service advocate for Lakes and Pines, located in Mora. As Jenny had mentioned, we do work with Aiken, Carlton, Chisago, Isani, Kennebec, and Mille Lacs, as well as Pine County. The transitional HYA funding that we received this year has truly been a blessing. It has made dreams become reality for some of the teens that we work in these communities. Finding affordable housing is a consistent issue and a daily struggle for many people, but especially for the youth, as they struggle with low incomes, and often they have children of their own that they're trying to support. Many of the youth population that I have come into contact with have reported that they have stayed in the following places to take shelter: vehicles, bathrooms at gas stations, relatives, friends, hospitals, campgrounds, couch hopping, Walmart, as well as college parking lots. The thing that these young people need, many people want to know. These young people need some support, guidance, and a voice. One young couple that I am working with got married at 18. They have a small infant, and they're now living on their own for the first time. One parent working and the mother staying home to take care of their son. They were struggling in all areas of their life and did not know where to turn or how to get back on their feet and be responsible parents. They began working with me in 2013, requesting financial assistance to get caught up on their rent, to which they fell behind because the husband had to job switch to be able to make more money. They were 3 months behind and on the verge of eviction, and they felt like they would never get out of debt, and they had fell that they had fell so far into. Through the HYA program, I was able to work with them, get them caught up on rent, prevent eviction and homelessness, as well as to help them acknowledge other areas of their life that they wanted to work on to be better and healthier for themselves, as well as to build a stronger family unit. They were afraid of losing their housing and having enough money to eat. They wanted to finish high school, to go to college, even to learn how to cook and other life skills, to pay bills on time and always pay rent first, learn needs versus wants, and how to save for an emergency fund. These clients set a goal around each of the above areas and have successfully accomplished each one of them one by one, and now are debt-free, ahead on their rent, buy food each month, have an emergency fund, as well as an additional savings account for their son, and now are working on their education as well as saving and taking the steps necessary to now buy their first home. Thank you.
Ms. Bowman, thank you for your testimony, and I was very glad to see when you guys were awarded that grant. I am quite familiar with the lack of homeless supports, both adult and children. You know, Pine City had the first one just 18 months ago, opened up for adults, but it did not include children, and your work has been great in this area. So thank you for providing your testimony. Any questions of members? Okay. Any other testifiers, Senator Dibble?
No, Mr. Chair.
So I'll open it up.
Just,
yeah.
So we'll open it up. Anyone from the public wish to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 2194? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Wendy Tentis. I represent the constituents and people who are victims of homelessness. I do have a question that I'd like to address. You may not have the answer, but how much of the budget is allocated to single adults?
Of the Homeless Youth Act budget, Ms.
Johnson? Of the Health and Human Services budget for the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Jensen, I'm going to need a little bit more clarity on a question. I'm not sure if this is in relation to Senate File 2194. We have a tight timeline. If you could focus your questions on the Homeless Youth Act, it would help us be efficient with our
limited time. Well, I did want to suggest a proportionate amount addressed within my address, but I'll let you determine that based on what I have to say. I ask that because the state seems to be prejudiced against single, poor, and homeless adults like it's a sin to be single. The majority of homeless do not get the help they need. The majority of homeless who do not get the help they need are the single adults 50 to 65 years of age, and they need a lot more help than they're getting. Welfare checks at a basic survival amount to begin with, and housing vouchers could be a start. A bit more prevention of foreclosures and evictions is also a good idea. So I'm sure you've studied the population, and you have your data correct, and I would like to make the aforementioned recommendations and adequate funding for all persons in the crisis of being a potential being or potentially being a homeless person.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Johnson.
I do have a question.
Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question. I'm not sure for it's for the testifier, but it is for probably Senator Dibble or perhaps Mr. Pittman.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, you know I'm a strong supporter of this, and the proposal that came up last year, we talked about the appropriations to Greater Minnesota, of course, which Mr. Pittman verified. But I'm looking at the figures of what is being dispersed to Greater Minnesota, and I'm looking at, and this is like a broken record, but if somebody doesn't say this, anything south of 94, Interstate 94 is about, all I see is Mankato and Rochester, not including the Scott Carver Dakota counties, which I call the kind of the donut ring of $185,000 for those three counties. But just Mankato and Rochester got $170,000 out of the entire $4 million or $4.2 million. I'm wondering why isn't Wilmer represented here, Marshall, perhaps even Worthington, Mankato should be getting quite a bit more. Because is it because they don't have drop-in centers? Is it because they haven't filed for grants? Because they certainly have the homeless youth. So I am concerned about the disparity of the appropriations.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rosen. It's an
Senator
excellent
Dibble.
Question. The department here, it was a through an RFP process that the department made the determination on the allocation, so they can respond. Thanks.
Welcome to the committee. I understand you're from DHS. State
Mr. Your name. Chair, Francie Mathis from DHS. And the awards were done through an RFP process. And we looked at the applications that came in to determine where the funds would go. In Wilmer, for instance, there was not Homeless Youth Act funding awarded to them, but some other funding from the general or the funding available to the general population to serve youth. And historically, we have funded that Lutheran Social Services youth program in Wilmer from our regular transitional housing funding. So they already had that funding, and we prioritized expansion programs throughout the state for this homeless youth funding. So there is funding from other funding sources. But I will say that in the Southwest, there were fewer applications, and I think some development needs to be done in that area of the state, well, probably the whole southern area of the state, to develop some programs for homeless youth.
Thank you, Mr. Rosen. Chair. And Ms. Franzi, what kind of support is that going to look like? How is that going to support those areas that, whether they're receiving transitional housing funding, which is, you know, we talked about the big white board. This is probably one of those things. You have the homeless youth in our youth programs. Where is the funding in? We have to make sure that there are no big voids. We talk about this all the time in this committee. Senator Dibble is the big white board about having, you know, you have the aging and you have youth and all these other programs. Where is the funding coming into so we make sure that everybody is getting served? And my concern is that we're not getting the supportive services to these areas, and they're probably handling them on their own because that's what they do, especially out in greater Minnesota. We don't, but they, if this is a program that should be statewide, we have to make sure that we do whatever we can to adjust the program and it reaches those areas that are not within the RFP qualifications.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I really appreciate your bringing this point up and revisiting it. And, of course, we've got the language in the bill that directs the agency to look at the whole state. I want to explore the question that was raised by the agency around developing those services and programs. You know, maybe we can allocate a certain number of dollars to build capacity. LSS, as you know, has a statewide reach. You know, maybe they have the ability to develop and or mentor some of these local community-based homeless youth-serving programs. I'd really like the opportunity to unpack that a little bit and figure out how to get the money into ready, willing, and able hands that are out there. Because that might be part of the problem is that there's just no one to give it to do the work. And right. So we need to develop those on-the-ground services, absolutely.
Senator Sharon?
Well, Senator Dibble spoke to what I thought was inherent in Senator Rosen's, and I would like the department, if they wouldn't mind, speak to what, if any, initiatives you're taking now to develop more resources in southern Minnesota in these areas that are not, may not even have adult shelters or youth shelters.
Ms. Mathis?
Rather than, you know, just as Senator Rosen funding those that already exist, which I think need more money, but there's huge gaps here in southern Minnesota, major areas of people gathering together, regional areas that apparently are not serving this population. So I'm wondering if what the department is doing within its own capacity right now.
Ms. Mathis?
Mr. Chair? The department has not been able to get out and do the outreach that I think is required. When we had the $4 million last year to award, we really focused on expansion of those willing, you know, people who applied. Even some of those were not as strong as youth providers, and we're very conscious of the fact that many homeless programs were developed by adults for adults, and youth are completely different. So we have some in the works, some training and development of those that were funded to better serve youth, but have not had a capacity to do outreach beyond that to other areas of the state, which is frankly needed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to add as well that not only rural communities but also suburbs are having that same issue that is raised by Senator Sharon and Senator Rosen. And I know that the faith-based community has come together and worked on making sure that there are avenues for youth. And I represent Edina, and I know that the faith-based community there is working with Beacon to bring homeless youth shelters to the area because it's underserved as well. Most of the services are in the metro. And I know that I hope that the department really does provide some more resources and potentially more focus on those underserved areas, and not just rural, but also the suburbs. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you.
You're moving the bill?
Yes, I am.
Excellent.
After a word. Mr. Chair, I just want to say a thank you to Senator Dibble for being a champion with this. I do appreciate that. And if anybody has ever had a chance to stop into one of the youth homeless shelters, take a visit. That's really important. And I took a visit into the one in the metro area, and I'll take you to your knees. So with that, I move that Senate File 2194 be recommended to pass and moved into the omnibus bill. Is that correct?
Laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for finance omnibus.
All right. Thanks.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I very much appreciate the consideration. I just want to mention it's been a heck of a tough winter, so that really puts a point on this. I also want to do a shout-out to Safe Harbors. They've been supportive of our efforts. We're supportive of their efforts. This is all very consistent with the mutual work that both initiatives undertake. I appreciate the consideration.
Thank you. All those in favor of Senator Rosen's motion signify by saying aye. Don't go anywhere, Senator Dibble. Oh, there you go. Okay. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Dibble, Senate File 1063.
Mr. Chairman, we have an amendment to Senate File 1063, which I've now misplaced.
This is its first hearing, so this would be an author's amendment to get it in
Mr.
shape.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's the A1 amendment.
Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Dibble on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll give a very brief description of what the bill intends to achieve, Senate File 1063. Then we have some folks who work in this field and have a ton of personal and professional experience with what is occurring in this situation. So this has to do with the establishment of pooled trusts for people with disabilities. This is people with disabilities who rely on medical assistance for their care and their services. And as we know, of course, appropriately so, folks need to be in need of those services because of their income. And that's well and appropriate, but it's been recognized by federal law that these individuals with disabilities are able to place some assets in a pooled trust that's administered by a third-party nonprofit entity, and the decision about how those assets get expended are made by that party. And this is to pay for, some modest things to help improve those folks' quality of life, because the income requirements and the asset ownership requirements are pretty stringent and pretty severe. And so your ability to have even some modest things that improve your quality of life or improve your housing circumstances are otherwise severely constrained. The state has determined or is of the opinion that something magic happens when folks turn 65 can't can't actually maintain those assets in a pool trust, and they impose a penalty, the penalties that we hear about, such that those assets really aren't available to them anymore. They have to disappear or go to pay for their care, or impose that gap in time when they don't qualify for care. And it is at variance with how a number of other states engage this practice, and the fact is that our own state has been unsuccessful in defending this practice in numerous instances. It just creates a circumstance where, and I'll also mention that these assets upon death do revert to the state to pay for care and or some remain in the trust to benefit the other members of the trust. It creates circumstances where, for instance, someone who becomes disabled as a result of someone else's fault can't even pursue a remedy to that circumstance because there's no point to it. And that's a shame. It creates a circumstance where the state itself can't realize some benefit from those sorts of settlements because no one's going to pursue them because there's really no point to it. So with that, I'll stop, and I'll introduce Lori Hansen, who has a lot of experience. She'll try to be brief. This is a highly technical arena, but we're going to try to boil it down to the bare essentials and try to illustrate why this is the wrong interpretation and practice by the state and the practical effect in people's lives.
And for members, if I could, I've worked with Senator Dibble on this for a couple of years now as well. I think this would be really meaningful policy to get implemented. If you read the fiscal note, you will see that the department does believe this is not allowable under federal law. And it's actually quite difficult to understand this just listening to conversation, which is one of the reasons I worked to ask them to produce something that is actually able to be digested. So members who do want to dig into this, I would suggest you actually take this fact sheet that's in your folder and read it. It actually does make a good deal of sense, but it's often best digested at a time when you can sit down and dig behind it. But we will take some more testimony, and then I'm sure the department is probably here to say why they feel it is not legal. But with that, Ms. Hansen, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Lori Hansen. I've been practicing law for 30 years, for the most part representing people who are aging and living with disabilities. And I thank you for your consideration of this bill, as I think it's very important to my clients and those people in this state. The fact sheet, as Senator Lowry explained, does explain the technical terms used here. I'll try not to use them. The bill concerns the intersection between the asset rules and the transfer rules that govern eligibility for medical assistance. In pertinent part, a person is eligible for medical assistance if they have $3,000, less than $3,000 in available assets. Assets that are put in a pooled trust aren't available. In other words, they don't count toward the $3,000. The transfer rules must be applied to each applicant of a medical assistance and each recipient of medical assistance. And medical assistance won't pay for long-term care services for a period of time, the length of which is determined by the amount given away. So if someone gives away money within that time, medical assistance will determine how long they're not going to pay for long-term care. But if an individual purchases something for value and they receive fair market value for that, then the medical assistance program doesn't impose a penalty. Assets placed in a pooled trust established and administered in accordance with federal Medicaid statute should not be penalized because the individual receives fair market value when they put the money in the trust. There's no argument that our individuals of all ages may place assets in a qualified pooled trust. Guardian and Protective Services, the ARC of Minnesota, and Lutheran Social Service all have qualified pooled trusts in Minnesota. But here's the problem. The Minnesota Department of Human Services is advising county agencies that if an individual over the age of 64 places funds in a pooled trust, there's no need to apply the asset transfer provisions. Rather, they just impose a penalty simply because the individual is over the age of 64. This position violates federal and state Medicaid law. It also violates two Minnesota District Court decisions. It violates the Olson decision in the Eighth Circuit Federal Court. And it violates CMS instructions which specifically state that asset provisions must apply. Last year, we met with DHS staff to discuss this issue. We were told, also in writing by Scott Leitz, that DHS would be applying the transfer provisions going forward. and they won't simply apply the penalty due to the age of the beneficiary. We were assured that no change in the statute was necessary. Unfortunately, that is not the case, and they are not applying the transfer provisions. Rather, they are still imposing a transfer simply because the individual is over the age of 65, or 65 and older. So here's how the statute affects people in Minnesota. People living in other states, for instance, Maryland, Ohio, and right next door in Wisconsin, are not penalized if they're 65 and older. They've been allowing this since 1993, and in fact, since the memo was issued that's quoted in the fiscal note in 2008, Maryland and Ohio's legislatures have looked at this and said, nope, you have to either apply the transfer provisions or simply what this bill says is transfers into pooled trust by individuals 65 and older are just fine. So for our clients, Mr. Zhuk, he wanted to be here, but unfortunately he died. But he's the client that got me involved in this issue in the first place because we were happily putting assets into pooled trust for people before 2008. And in Mr. Zhuk in 2008 was in his 80s. He had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1953, and he had to move into a skilled nursing facility in 2003. He spent $400,000 of his own money and had $12,000 left and thought, what am I going to do? I have to apply for medical assistance to pay for my care. He had the use of his left hand only, and his whole life was going to Perkins, so he had to pay for transportation, ordering shrimp on Fridays, and having a cell phone, watching movies, listening to music, and books on tape. He could not afford that on the amount of money that he got to keep in the nursing home, so he put his last $12,000 into the GAPS pooled trust subaccount. This was the first time we had heard that there was going to be a penalty. DHS instructed Douglas County to impose a period of ineligibility solely because he was over the age of 64 at the time his money was put into the trust. Douglas County District Court Judge Ann Carrot reversed the department, sent it back down, and told them, hey, you've got to look to see whether or not they got fair market value. DHS, again, didn't do that. They just submitted a written brief that said, basically, we think because they're over the age of 64, the penalty should be imposed. Judge Carrot reversed the penalty and said that, okay, you had to put fair market value. We have another, you have to get fair market value. So the district court in Dakota County with another client stated the same thing. And that was the years before last year when we met with DHS. And this year there's a case pending in Blue Earth County, which is exactly the same, except for it's just a little more egregious because the beneficiary negotiated with DHS. And they said, okay, on the Medicaid subrogation lien, so they paid some money to DHS, and then they all agreed you're going to put the money in a pooled trust. But when the client went over to put the money in the pooled trust, again, a penalty was imposed. Courts all over the country are finding that placing assets into a pooled trust subaccount is a transfer for fair market value. Why? Because they're not giving any money away. They're giving it to the trust. The trust has to spend it on them up to the last penny. And also the Ken Borley, who is the president of finance and the chief financial officer for Lutheran Social Service, testified in one of the hearings that they have a contractual obligation to pay for items and services for the sole benefit of the beneficiary. So if they don't pay for the beneficiary when the beneficiary puts the money in, it's like they're breaching the contract, exploiting a vulnerable adult. They have to do it. So this bill clarifies that when individuals place money into a pooled trust subaccount, they should be able to do so without penalty. And I thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. I'm not sure.
I'm Joel Smith.
Joel Smith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'll keep my points brief. I wish I knew half of what Lori Hansen knows. I don't know that side of pooled trust. But what I do know, in my law practice, my partner and I represent vulnerable adults who've been injured in care facilities like nursing homes. Most of those people are over 65 years old. Most of them are on medical assistance. And as Lori explained, there's, you know, as you know very well, the eligibility requirements. My office, my partner and I, we get about 30 phone calls a month of people asking us to review their cases. We take about 1 out of 20 cases. The 19 that we turn down, many of them have merit. It's just not feasible to handle them. There are a number of reasons why it's not feasible to handle them, but one of the primary ones is if it's a case where the person is on medical assistance and we do a good job of proving that the nursing home was negligent and perhaps somebody was dropped from a Hoyer lift, there's fracture injuries, who's paying for the medical bills? It's Medicare and medical assistance. I effectively serve as an agent for the government in representing my client because the recovery of a claim on behalf of my client also recovers the money for medical assistance or Medicare under the statutory formulas that apply to their getting their money back. If, after all of that, my client who's on medical assistance, who's over 65 or over, has $10,000, $15,000, $25,000, $30,000 net in the recovery, really, in many circumstances, that creates more problems for them than it solves. We figured that out a few years ago. And so if we can't make it better for our client, what's the point in doing it? And those are some of the 19 out of the 20 cases that we turned down. The case has merit. The nursing home did wrong. It's just not feasible for us or my client to go forward with that case. And the government, whether it's medical assistance or Medicare, that paid sometimes $25,000, $50,000, $60,000 for medical care resulting from that injury, they're not going to get the money back. They could if they went after it on their own, but I haven't seen that happen. So as their agent, if I can't take that case, because under this pooled trust management, it puts my client in a worse position than if I just don't take the case, we're not taking those cases. I think that's a disservice both to medical assistance, Medicare, to my clients, to these people that deserve representation, and part of the representation is trying to hold people accountable for when these things happen. That's the side of this that I know, and I certainly admire all that Lori knows and your committee knows, but the practical effect of it is it's a dissuasion from trying to do something that the law should be there to promote some effective change. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Dayton, is that correct? And we're going to have to be kind of brief. I know DHS wants to come forward and state their case as well. And I need to say we're actually not a court of law. We're not going to adjudicate this matter here today. But I'm glad to get the story.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I will try to be as brief as I have submitted written testimony for the committee, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of points that I make therein. My name is Kim Dayton.
Professor Dayton,
you don't have it?
We don't have it. If you're, we'd be happy to make it.
We'll print it.
Okay. I will see that the committee gets the written testimony. My name is Kim Dayton. I'm an emerita professor of law at William Mitchell. I've been the director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy since 2007. My areas of specialty are law and aging and disability law, and I have also taught civil procedure at both Mitchell and the University of Kansas for almost 28 years. I believe that imposing a transfer penalty on persons over the age of 64 who transfer funds to a pooled trust, Minnesota is in violation of federal law. I also believe that in ignoring court decisions that have fully resolved the question of whether there is an age limit restricting such transfers, the Department of Human Services flouts basic principles of collateral estoppel and res judicata. The purpose of the pooled trust provisions of the federal Medicaid statute is to allow individuals of all ages who have severe disabilities to have access to those material goods and services that make life worth living. Although Medicaid pays many of the costs associated with living in a nursing facility or receiving long-term care at home, the program certainly does not cover all of one's needs. A person living in a skilled nursing facility who is on Medicaid, for example, is allowed to keep only $95 a month in income. This sum must cover the cost of clothing, reading materials other than what's
food other than what's provided in the facility, access to media such as newspapers and magazines, access to custodial and related services not paid for by Medicaid, which includes such basics as transportation for purposes other than medical treatment, some assistive technology, and so forth. Persons living at home are only allowed to keep income up to 100% of the federal poverty threshold. The notion that persons with disabilities should be deprived of things like the list of items that I have read off to you simply because they are disabled is inconsistent with the purposes of the federal pooled trust law, and it is morally wrong. Although two different courts in Minnesota have held that a transfer by a person over the age of 64 is not subject to a penalty because there was no evidence that the transfer was not for fair market value, the Department of Human Services continues to instruct county agents to assess a penalty against persons making such transfers without conducting a fair market value analysis. The department is ignoring the mandate of the courts in this area, a mandate that stems from an interpretation of federal law. As such, basic principles of claim and issue preclusion hold that the department is bound to follow those decisions in all subsequent situations involving transfers to a pooled trust. The court has failed to honor the judicial decisions in this area, and as such, it is up to the legislature to codify those decisions. DHS has had the opportunity to appeal those decisions and has chosen not to do so. It is wasteful of both state and personal resources and grossly unfair to those with disabilities to require them to have to litigate these issues every time an individual wishes to transfer funds as permitted by state law into a pooled trust. These individuals must already bear the burden of their disabilities. Requiring them to litigate to enforce their rights is simply not fair.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there someone here from DHS that would like to speak to the DHS interpretation of the federal law? Again, I will reiterate, we are not a court. We are not going to decide this case today. But we do take it seriously. And I honestly think this is really good public policy if we could get this. And so DHS's interpretation would be important for us to understand. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kim Carlin from DHS. The department had not asked to testify on this bill, but we are happy to answer questions from the committee.
Well, I guess the question would be, why is it your interpretation that this is in violation of federal law?
Mr. Chair, the department does not dispute the fact that people can put assets into a pooled trust after age 65, nor that a fair market value analysis should be made. However, the bill states that all transfers into pooled trusts are not subject to penalty.
I guess I'm not totally clear on that interpretation. I'm reading the assumptions. We asked for a fiscal note. We've been given one that signed up. It says there's zero cost, and in the assumptions it says DHS did not prepare a fiscal estimate for this legislation, as adopting this policy would be in violation of Section 1917D of the Social Security Act, which regulates the treatment of trust. Is there a way to address your issues in this and make it so that people over the age of 64 would be able to have their pooled trusts protected and treated in the manner that would be consistent with what Senator Dibble is attempting to do? And then we could, if so, that technical assistance would have been helpful ahead of the time, ahead of committee, so that we could actually understand the fiscal implications if we were able to accomplish this policy goal that actually I think is a good one.
Mr. Chair, the language in the bill on line 2.6 says an individual may fund or establish a sub-account in a pooled trust without an age limit or a transfer penalty. I don't want to mislead you to think that that taking that out would solve issues. The CMS guidance and the federal law, Medicaid law, generally talks about assets that are transferred into a trust as a transfer without compensation. Generally, that is how transfers into irrevocable trusts are treated. In the guidance from CMS, it is noted that, yes, an analysis has to be made, but generally, assets transferred into a trust take those assets out of the control of the person, and I believe their words are, when a person places funds in a trust, the person gives up ownership of those funds. Since the individual generally does not receive anything of comparable value in return, placing funds in a trust is usually a transfer for less than fair market value. So we don't believe that the statute requires any changes. The department does not say all transfers into pooled trusts are specifically are transfers without compensation. However, most under the guidance of CMS would be considered transfers for less than fair market value. The CMS has instructed states to not that they may not disregard that analysis for transfers by individuals over age 65.
Miss, I forgot your name. I'm sorry.
Carlin.
Okay. I just didn't hear that. What is it?
Carlin.
Carlin? Okay, Miss mm-hmm. Carlin. In testimony, it was stated that there's this magic age of 65, where you apply one set of rules below that age and one set of rules above that age. Is that the determination you use to...
Mr. Chair, the federal law requires that transfers into trust generally are transfers for less than fair market value. There are certain types of trusts that are exempt from that analysis. And one is pooled trusts for individuals under age 64. And so even though we do not count the assets in the trust at any age, they are excluded from counting towards a person's countable assets. The federal law specifically states that transfers into trusts over the age of 65 are not exempt from the transfer penalty evaluation. So it's the federal law that states that.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I understand that this is not a court of law.
You're going to have to start calling me Your Honor pretty soon.
I know. All I'm saying is that the federal law does not state that there should be a penalty. In fact, if we were to analyze the two provisions of the federal statute, both dealing with transfers and dealing with pool trusts, you could see how the analysis goes. And so that's kind of where the problem has been, and that's why the states are split and how they're handled. But the true truth is you cannot rely on a statement saying that the federal law prohibits it, because it simply doesn't. There are states that are allowing it. I've called the advocates in those states after our meeting and said, is anybody giving you guys a hard time about this? And the answer is no. And in fact, Wisconsin had a round in their legislature just a few months ago.
Help me understand the timelines here. When is this CMS guidance that you're relying on, Ms. Carolyn?
Mr. Chair, the guidance what came out in, April of 2008.
Okay.
And then
so
also
this has been there for a long time. This guidance has been around for a long time, and it sounds like courts have decided against you in this interpretation several times since 2008 in the courts in Minnesota. Is that
yes.
my understanding as well?
Are you asking me, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the case that Ms. Hansen referred to did not overturn it's consistent with our policy. It said that transfers into trusts over age 65 must be evaluated. That's what that Eighth Circuit decision said. Further, after our meetings with Ms. Hansen last year after the bill was introduced, we contacted CMS to reconfirm our understanding of their guidance, and that understanding was confirmed by CMS in conversations with them following our meetings with Ms. Hansen. And she was, you know, we did notify Ms. Hansen of that conversation.
Ms. Hansen, briefly in response.
Briefly, I have an email from Scott Leitz after that meeting, and I also talked with Gene Coffey from CMS, and it was confirmed that the transfer analysis has to happen. And we've got that in writing. Yes, they take the position that you don't get anything for value if you apply the transfer policy, but that's our point, is that when we put that before a court, and every court that's looked at that at the district court level throughout the country has said, yep, you're right, it is a transfer for value. And so that's where the disconnect here is what does it mean to apply the policy? It means you've got to look, and you've got to say, all right, if we put money into a pool trust, is it a fair market value transfer? And I think that's why Wisconsin, and that's why Maryland and Ohio are saying, yep, we can just say anybody over the age of 64 can put it in because it's a fair market value transfer.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the guidance from the federal government allows states to essentially waive the penalty, or is that a must? Does the federal law state that we must assess a penalty?
Mr. Chair, The federal law requires that transfers into pooled trust by a person over age 65 be evaluated to determine if fair market value was received. Generally speaking, in statute regarding transfers into trusts, they are considered to be transfers for less than fair market value because a person has put their assets outside of their control. So the federal law does not prohibit us from evaluating it. It does require an evaluation, but the guidance from CMS in that relative to that evaluation states that generally speaking, there is no adequate compensation for transfers into a trust, pooled or pooled trust or otherwise.
So, Ms. Carolyn, at the page 2, line 6 and 7 sentence that says that an individual may fund or establish a subaccount without age limit or transfer penalty. You're saying that would preclude you from doing the evaluation. Would we be able to tell you how your evaluation should be evaluated instead of taking away the ability for you to do an evaluation? I mean, honestly, if we could get some technical assistance that would help us meet this policy objective, maybe we could actually get to a conversation about what this would cost in our finance division here, and that would be very helpful. Again, we're not going to solve this today, right here. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think that's an important way to go with this, because I think the point is that people aren't trying to artificially divest themselves of resources in order to qualify for medical assistance. That's not what they're trying to do. That's what right. The law's objective is to prevent that kind of activity, and that's not what it's occurring here. People aren't, you know, giving their kids, you know, $500,000 in order to artificially impoverish themselves so that they qualify for medical right. assistance. That's not what's happening here. Yet that is what is being construed to happen just by definition of putting these dollars into pooled trusts. They're doing the same thing that other people who put pooled money into pooled trusts do. It's just that they're, you know, other disabled people, it's just that they're 65 or older. I think we can get there.
Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with your analysis or your intent to try to get some technical assistance, but I don't think my question was answered, so for the record.
Senator Lurie?
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, in hearing that, I look at line 2.6, paragraph D. Does it work? I don't know. This evaluation seems to be a big deal to say, after an evaluation, comma, an individual, and proceed with the rest of the language. Does that mess it up? Or is that suggestion in any way possible or helpful?
Mr. Chair, that's a little
Senator Dibble?
Yeah.
not being a court of law and not being a lawyer like the chair is.
There's a couple of us around the table.
Yeah, I got a couple around here. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I do think we would need to take some time, figure it out, and nail it down with precision.
Ms. Carolyn, are you willing to engage in a round of technical assistance and try to see if there's a way to achieve these policy objectives so that we can fairly evaluate what the cost would be if we could meet these objectives? Is that something you're willing to do, sit down with the advocates trying to this policy forwarded?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. The department will cooperate always in any request for technical assistance. We did have extensive conversations with Ms. Hansen last year. I'm not sure, and we certainly are willing to have further discussions. I don't know that we have any additional information that would be beneficial, but we certainly can talk with you again around this, around the idea that there's some way to quantify when fair market value is achieved.
Right.
I do want to say that I would be wanting to understand then, would this apply to transfers into all trusts? You know, would this be globally then?
That's the technical assistance that we'd be asking for. How could we determine the procedure by which you would evaluate whether it's a transfer for fair market value? I mean, I think maybe that's a fair way to frame it. How can we define in statute in a manner consistent with federal law allowing you to evaluate but tell you how to evaluate fair market value? I mean, I think from my understanding, that may be accomplishable, able to be accomplished and be consistent with the CMS guidance. But we could use that technical assistance to try to get there and then again find out what this would cost. That's one of the big objectives that we're trying to accomplish here. Senator Sharon?
Yes, I'm sorry if my questions probably are not at the level that you're asking.
Fine.
They're just general high level. I am just curious to know, Senator Dibble could probably answer these. Is there a limitation on the size of this trust? And upon death, what happens to the remaining assets?
Senator Dibble can answer these.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to the first. I'll ask Ms. Hansen.
There is no limit, Your Honor.
Right.
I'm sorry. Finally, somebody calls me Your Honor. That's a rare occasion around here, but anyway, something I really deserve.
Your dad.
Oh, and what happens to it at death? Mr. Chair, Senator
Sharon.
At death, the pool trust is allowed to keep 10% of the pool trust subaccount, and then the remainder is paid back to the state of Minnesota for medical assistance benefits paid.
And we worked very hard to make sure that that was incorporated in the bill when I was working with Senator Dibble on it last year. That was a very important piece that the state still make sure we're made whole at the end. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to commend the parties for having worked so hard to get to this point. We are trying to make good public policy. It's the department's responsibility to assist us. And frankly, if we need to bump up against the feds to do something that is fundamentally good policy, this isn't about enriching a future generation or somebody hiding assets. This is good policy for disabled people. And so I would encourage the department to do everything you can to assist us in making good policy. And if we need to push back on the feds, then that is what we should do because that is good policy.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your direction, I'm happy to work with the agency. I do have to report, though, that I was a part of those conversations in the past year plus, and it wasn't a problem-solving exercise. It was just a simply restatement and restatement and restatement of why we're right and you're wrong.
So well, hopefully
I appreciate the direction from Senator Benson and everyone.
Senator Benson moves that Senate file 1063 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. And in the meantime, maybe the parties can work on language a little bit and help us if we can get to a point where we can understand the fiscal but it is a short timeline. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Sharon, Senate File 2182, Recovery School Programs Grants Appropriation.
Good morning. I'm here to present Senate File 2182, which we are calling the Sober Schools Bill. This is a bill that is attempting to alleviate the funding issues Minnesota's sober schools have been experiencing. Because the funding for sober schools comes from the education formula, none of the services these schools provide students with regard to chemical dependency services are able to be funded through education funding. As a result, eight of these needed schools have closed over the last few years. There are only four sober schools remaining: PEASE Academy in Minneapolis, Central Freedom Recovery School in Mankato, ALC Recovery School in Detroit Lakes, and Insight Program in White Bear Lake. These schools are attempting to meet budget needs through fundraising and grant writing. Our goal with this legislation is to make sure that the school's mission, which is to help students remain sober while finishing their education, is funded through public health care dollars. I've with me Michael Derschlag, director of PEASE Academy, and Ian McGregor, a student from PEASE, to testify on this bill.
Thank you. Michael Derschlag, would you like to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. My name is Michael Derschlag. I'm the director of PEASE Academy. PEASE Academy is actually the oldest recovery high school in the United States of America. We've been operating since February of 1989. I have not had the pleasure of working there for the entire time. I started working there as a social studies teacher in 1995, and in January of 2007 became the director. We think recovery schools, both in the state and nationally, are a really important part of the ongoing treatment and ongoing care for adolescents once they get out of a care and treatment facility. As a matter of fact, a lot of people think it's a necessary part. Unfortunately, when young people end up going back to their home school or another high school, it's a recipe for disaster for their ongoing recovery. That's where recovery schools kind of come into place. We provide a safe, sober environment for students to get a good education, graduate, and most of our students at PEASE Academy actually end up going on to college and university. The work that we do at PEASE Academy and why we think it's a public health issue for the care and for our licensed chemical and drug counselor, because it helps keep students out of, or adolescents out of, treatment facilities down the road, helps them stay out of ongoing legal issues, and provide some stability for them and their families. We know we're a school, but we also provide the care and treatment stuff too.
Thank you, Mr. Derschlag. As far as the Compass and I-90, where are you? South, right?
94.
94, I mean.
He Mr. Chair. Nobody's had any.
Just trying to
here,
anticipate.
So. Mr. Chair, we're located right in the heart of Dinkytown, right by the University.
Oh, you are? I thought you were the one from Mankato. I'm sorry. Okay.
I wonder why you'd think that.
And then Ian McGregor, thank you for taking time out of your day and coming to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Ian McGregor, and I'm an addict. I've been attending PEASE Academy for the last 2 years, and frankly, PEASE has more or less saved my life. If I would have had to return to my home high school after going through treatment, I would have continued to use. I would have continued to be a detriment to society, and I would have continued to do my utmost to further my addiction. And As I showed through my use, it would have ended in death. And I can say that I know many of my fellow students feel the same way. Peas, I really do owe my life to this school. If I would have had to see all of the old friends I used to use with, I don't think any power in this world in my early sobriety could have stopped me from going back out. I've honestly completely turned my life around. 2 years ago, I was coming out of my 10th overdose that I shouldn't have survived. Now, I'm on my way to college at St. Cloud State University. I've gotten around $6,000 in scholarships a year. I just celebrated a year clean from any mind or mood altering chemical. I've repaired relationships with friends, family. I've made amends to those people I've harmed in my use, and that's all thanks to Pease. The level of debt that I have to this school is unrepayable, so I just would like to thank them for the opportunity to come here and help represent this cause, because it really is needed. If we lose these last four sober schools, I promise you that the number of living addicts is going to decrease. There's going to be more overdoses. There's going to be more suicides. Peace is a lifeline.
Mr. McGregor, thank you for coming and sharing your story. And
thank you.
And Mr. Dershlag, thank you for all you do to help kids. Senator Sharon, did you?
Well, I just really appreciate the fact that we have a real-life story here to talk about this situation. I want to just name the programs that have closed here. Arona Campus in Shoreview, Cass Lake Gateway Program in St. Paul, Sobriety Campus in Edina, Sobriety High Campus in Burnsville, Chaska's Solace Academy, Spring Lake Park Safe Harbor, and Owatonna's Recovery School in southern Minnesota. And as you heard from the testimony, we all know, all of us that are on the various committees for Health and Human Services, we deal a great deal with trying to support a recovery process for persons with chemical dependency. The pressures and the environment for recovery after a person comes to terms with the fact that they have a problem and they break through that denial system and accept that it is a problem, there's still so much that needs to be provided to support that person to be in an environment where they can hold on to that fragile recovery. And for young people, especially, who have yet developed those skills to be able to deal with external pressures, we need to make an extra effort. And I think this is a sad statement for us to be looking at the fact that we've been losing these sober schools that help young people survive. So I'm just here as a very strong advocate for us finding money through the Chemical Dependency Treatment Consolidated Fund for these projects, even though it's a change of where our funding obligation typically would be.
You're fourth, actually. Okay. We've drawn a lot of attention here. Senator Rosen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McGregor, thank you very much for coming, and very well spoken, by the way. This is a little intimidating to be in front of us, and you did very well. I have two questions for you. One, if you don't mind, what was your addiction, if you wouldn't mind sharing? And the second question is, what is it about the Pease Academy that has worked for you? Because, as we all know, it's the aftercare for yeah. chemical dependency. And to me, what I'm hearing is that there is this, it's maybe a different way of aftercare, but it's still a form of aftercare, and it worked for you. So if you can tell us a little bit about
Mr.
that.
Mr. McGregor.
Thank you. To answer the first question, I was what you would call a garbage can in my addiction. Anything you put in me, I wouldn't care. I'd take it. But my drug of choice was heroin and alcohol. And then what Pease did for me as far as aftercare goes is the level of people that use recreationally in high school is incredibly high. And for an addict, recreational just doesn't make sense to us. Like, I couldn't understand having one beer and watching a football game. I don't understand drinking and not getting drunk. That doesn't make sense to me. What Pease did was it put me around people who understood that and were of the same mindset and held the same values as me. if I would have been on my own, I would have eventually conformed and went back to drinking because I would have had no one to share my struggles with, no one to have sober activities with. What PEAS did was it gave me people I could attend meetings with. It gave me a counselor I could speak with if I was having troubles at home, if I was having troubles with relationships in my life. It gave me a sober support network that I needed, because no matter how good of a program you work, you'll always, always have those doubts of yourself, and you always will need someone to call.
Thank you. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, Senator Sharon, I've forgotten the name of your first testifier.
I'll have him say it.
Okay. Mr. Dershlag.
Dershlag.
I didn't want to mispronounce it, Dershlag.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Dershlag, I understood that in Anoka Hennepin there was a sober high school. I visited it, but it's been a while. Is that high school still there? I didn't hear it on either list of the ones that were open or closed, and if you could help me clarify.
Mr. Dershlag, do you have the answer to that?
Yes, they're one of the recovery high schools that closed last year, and there is one other one that was missing from that, and that was down in Eden Prairie that closed last year, too. Last year, at the end of the last school year, we lost three recovery high schools. Arona, which is the one that you're referring to, is one of those one that's closed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
And Senator Sharon, those kids really did appreciate having the commonality for post-treatment. And so if we can help, Anoka Hennepin has had a terrible problem with heroin, multiple deaths, designer drugs, a party where 10 kids ended up being taken to the hospital. And it is a tragedy to see this continue to happen. And so the loss of a safe place. So when the kids get out and they've done the work of recovery and acknowledging where they are, to put them back in a high school where it's way too easy to get these drugs. It seems unfair for the amount of work that they've had to do to get where they are. So thank you, Senator Sharon.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon and Mr. Dershlag and Mr. McGregor, thank you guys for coming over. This is an issue that I watch really closely as well. I think many of the committee members know that my father has a treatment center that he runs, and my wife works for the Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation, I guess it's what it's called. So I'm pretty familiar with the work that you do. So thank you, and I think it is absolutely something that we should continue to invest in, is the ideal of recovery and all the facets that it takes. I do have, Senator Sharon, more, Ms. Chair, more of a process question about the model and the sustainability of the model. And I know that this kind of cross paths with the education committee as well, but I am a little curious, as much as I support this, as to the dollars that we get from the Consolidated Treatment Fund, what do those dollars do? Because I don't think that consolidated treatment dollars would cover, you know, teachers, right? They'd cover counselors and things that we do out of that fund. And then are we able to sustain it? Because the issue that, at least through the article and even what we're saying around closing, is the lack of sustainability. So as much as I want to be able to support this, I want to better understand kind of what the sustainability plan is in order to resource these schools appropriately.
Senator Sharon?
Please, I would ask that we have a person who can speak with some expertise to this answer the question.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Sarah Erickson, and I represent CORI, the Coalition of Recovery Investment. And to answer your first question, when we wrote this bill, we wrote it before the final forecast came out, and we were trying to think creatively given the budget constraints that we were under. We realized that there was an $18 million line item last year in the budget that took money out of that fund to send it to the general fund. We were hoping that when the forecast came out that there would be a little money left on the bottom line, and that it wouldn't have been booked anywhere, so it wouldn't have affected the general fund. So we were trying to think incredibly creatively given kind of where you guys are from a financial perspective.
we would really appreciate and like the opportunity to continue to work with the chair over the next week to 10 days to kind of try and think creatively about how we can fund this program. And as far as ongoing sustainability, we were trying to make incremental progress in the area of recovery in 2014 and plan to have a much more robust package in 2015 that hopefully will address those ongoing funding concerns.
This money is there. So, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Erickson and Senator Sharon, I think, you know, once again, I don't have a problem with it, but I do think that, you know, I have some ideas, you know, that I've floated around in my head as we continue down the Affordable Care Act and we go towards the transition of getting Medicaid to help pay for treatment costs that then frees up dollars out of the Consolidated Treatment Fund. And I want to really hold those to working with people in recovery, prevention in recovery, right? I think that that's where we need to invest. But I am still interested, and we can talk offline about the model, where the money will go, and then the cross-section with the Department of Education. In the article, it spoke about one of the issues is transportation costs for the students and other things that maybe should be paid for out of the Department of Education, and the ability for us to pull those money together and target them so that not only can PEAS continue to be successful, but places in southern Minnesota, Anoka County, and other parts of the state where young people are struggling with addiction and recovery can get these benefits as well.
And then, members, we have three more members who wish to speak to this issue and another bill that needs to be heard. So we're going to have to start trying to be pretty brief. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, I'm just wondering with the facility, if you know, if the facilities that have closed, is it due to solely a financial issue?
Can you? Mr. Derschlag, welcome back.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself.
Michael Derschlag. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The my understanding, I don't have exact knowledge of all the different school closings, but yes, my understanding is financial reasons. We're trying to pay for our licensed alcohol and drug counselors through education funding. It's just stretched some of them too thin, and some of the schools are just very small by nature, and kind of a fluctuating student enrollment was really kind of what I think doomed them.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Derschlag, partly on what Senator Hayden's question was, is this enough money? Well, what I don't want to make the mistake of doing is giving $100,000 to a school and then seeing it close its doors at the end of the year because it wasn't enough funding. To me, that would be somewhat of a waste. So is this a Band-Aid until, as Ms. Erickson said, next year when we can get more funding in the next budget? Or is this adequate funding for what your needs are?
Mr. Derschlag?
I think that's a very fair question, and I believe talking to some of the other schools that is adequate funding. And I know that the four schools are still in existence. Will be open next year, too.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Clausen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having been a high school principal, I really appreciate Mr. McGregor's comments, and having seen what he's gone through and students that try to come back to their home school and just doesn't work because of the environment. We were in a large enough district that we would actually transfer the students within our district to another school with five high schools. But even at that time, being in that community many times and friends, that environment just wasn't working. Picking up on a couple of comments from Senators Brown and Senator Hayden and having some familiarity with the Burnsville program that we had, I do have some concerns about the sustainability of the program. I think the economy of scale that these programs are working under is not sustainable because of inadequate funding. I think we need to treat these schools a little bit differently than how we normally would fund high schools that size. I know very few high schools can afford to have a chemical dependency counselor. I think maybe the Wayzata schools may be the only school district that has a chemical dependency counselor in the building. So I think this is a bigger issue we need to take a look at. The economy of scale and what these schools have to, the expenses that they have, and what we can do in the future to make sure that they continue. So, again, I appreciate you coming here, and I'm very supportive, but I think we need to look at a bigger picture on this issue as well.
Thank you. Senator Rosen?
Thank you. Well, and that's Senator Claussen just nailed it, too. And if you read this article from the Star Tribune, it really does spell it out very well. This needs a lot more work because Minnesota did start the model, it says, and you had a chemical dependency field and well-intentioned parents trying to start and run these schools and not really necessarily business people. So there has to be a support system here, and it's not – we haven't fit that – we haven't found that sweet spot yet. So this is we can't allow this to continue because this is part of the recovery plan.
Senator Sharon, you have a motion
well,
for
no,
us?
I think that the long-term sustainability issue is the correct issue. Yeah. This is looking for some sustaining short-term solution. But our commitment, this group's commitment, is to a long-term solution because the unique character of a sober school is what Ian was describing, that it created an environment that removed some of the difficulties that a person early in recovery is not able to manage. And you have to give some space in an environment in order for a person to be successful in recovery that's appropriate to their age. And so a long-term solution is absolutely important that takes into account that you have to have a certain number of people in order to make a school like this work. So we do need to look at it and be strategic about it. But today we're talking about some short-term sustainability before we lose the whole system.
So Senator Sharon moves
Senate File 2182
be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS article for the finance omnibus. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Sharon. And thank you for again for coming and sharing your story, Mr. McGregor. Senator Franzen. Senate File 2392.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill, Senator Lori, thanks for the opportunity to bring this bill forward on behalf of the University of Minnesota and Platts Children's Hospital. The purpose is to provide a technical correction to the original language in the Health and Human Services omnibus bill that was signed into law during the 2011 special session. The intent of the original legislation was to exempt the state's children's hospitals, including the university.
Senator Franzen, you have an A2 author's amendment?
I do.
Senator Franzen moves the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
1-0.
The intent of the original legislation was to exempt the state's children's hospitals, including the university children's hospitals, from the 10% medical rate reduction. The University of Minnesota Amplatz Children's Hospital is the largest pediatric provider of Medicaid services in Minnesota, the largest provider of pediatric behavioral health services, and the largest provider of pediatric technical teaching hospitals, in Minnesota. Amplatz is a very important community asset and provider of children's health care. And some of us have had the opportunity to tour the hospital in the recent months, so you can see for yourself how important this facility is for our community. With me, I have Ms. Carolyn Wilson, the president of the hospital. We're here with me, and she will provide a few more details about important services they provide and why this is needed to make this technical correction.
Thank you, Senator Franzen. Good morning, Chair Lowry and committee members. My name is Carolyn Wilson. I'm a registered nurse serving the state in the capacity as Fairview's Chief Operating Officer and President of the University of Minnesota Medical Center. Each and every day, our academic hospital treats thousands of Minnesotans in our hospital rooms, outpatient clinics, emergency departments, and surgical suites. We perform the most complex care available. We are the state's largest provider of behavioral health care services and Medicaid services, helping ensure access to all Minnesotans. In 2011, we brought together all of our children's services into a single location when we opened the University of Minnesota Amplatz Children's Hospital. The state-of-the-art facility is dedicated to Children's Healthcare and is located on the west bank of the Mississippi River in Minneapolis. Last year, children from all 87 counties in Minnesota sought care at our hospital, including more than $54 million worth of Medicaid services, more than any other Minnesota children's hospital. Our hospital features 267 beds and bassinets, private family-friendly rooms, and the Twin Cities' widest range of pediatric services. Our services include surgery, imaging, neonatal and pediatric intensive care, cardiac and oncology services, blood and marrow transplant, as well as solid organ transplantation. Through our affiliation with the University of Minnesota Medical School, our patients and families have access to the latest medical breakthroughs and care that is not available elsewhere. Key features of our hospital include a dedicated pediatric emergency room, including two trauma bays, as well as six state-of-the-art operating rooms and a children's observation and sedation unit. To give you a better sense of our children's hospital, I brought photos with me, and I hope you have those.
We do.
So that you could see the wonderful facility and some of the children that we serve. Families come to us for many reasons, many because of the unique care. For example, we have achieved the best long-term and quality-of-life survival outcomes in the care of cystic fibrosis. We also have one of the largest infant and small children kidney transplant programs, including the state's only pediatric dialysis center. Our care of pediatric heart patients is also world-leading. We recently implanted the first Berlin heart in a child in Minnesota to serve as a bridge to transplant. Finally, we are really proud to have Minnesota's only child's behavioral inpatient unit and programming exclusively dedicated to children ages 12 or younger. We take care of more pediatric behavioral health patients than any other hospital in Minnesota. We are also proud of our commitment to the future of medicine. Our hospital is a top pediatric hospital in the upper Midwest and, in fact, is one of the nation's top 20 pediatric research programs. Our doctors apply innovative approaches to creating medical breakthroughs. This has led to several firsts. We were the first children's hospital to accomplish a successful pediatric blood and marrow transplant, the first infant heart transplant in Minnesota, and the first pediatric cochlear implant surgery.
Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
We're all pretty familiar and very right. fond of AMPLATS.
we'll go to the end. We'll wrap it up.
The issue before us really has to do with legislative intent from, you know, the 2011 rate cut. I mean, we actually have a letter in our packets from the chairs from both the House and the Senate speaking to what the legislative intent was at the time this this law was passed. And so really the bill before us is a correction to try to put legislative intent into the statute, and the fiscal note before us is the current estimates of what it would cost to institute that legislative intent. And so I think that with that, we'll maybe open it up to a couple of questions, if that's all right. Did you have
– No, please.
Okay. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my question is for the department. And my question has to do with how could you construe that the children's hospitals in current law would somehow exclude AMPLATS? I don't understand, because why should we even have to do this is what I'm saying, because how do they get a definition out of there that would not include AMPLATS? I mean, it seems obvious. They're a children's hospital. Can the department explain why
Senator
they would
Kiffmeyer,
define
the
that?
The department is here. You know, I think that it's fairly ambiguous in the statute. I think when you get behind it, and the department can speak to that, you know, there was an initial determination by the department that it would be covered according to legislative intent. There was a question raised. They did an analysis and determined that on a technical read, it actually didn't qualify. That's their internal analysis. We're looking at this and saying, you know, it was the Senator Franzen's position is it was the legislative intent. We have a letter from both of the chairs that is the case. I mean, that's the situation that we find ourselves in today. So we can call the department up and ask them, but at this point it's rather academic as to what it is. We have legislation before us that would clarify that, and truthfully, in the legislature, there is an issue brought before us that I think we do need to work on additional clarity about exactly what we do mean when we speak of children's hospitals. And I know from paying attention to this committee, sometimes we mean AMPLATS in there, sometimes we don't, sometimes, you know, Essentia has a children's hospital, Mayo has a children's hospital. We need to be much more specific than we have in the past, and this the issues surrounding this particular bill have highlighted that clearly for us, and I think we will do just that. And this is a proposal to restore legislative intent from the bill when that was passed. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree if we can. I hate to be so specific that we are calling out, you know, university-affiliated hospital. We definitely want the funding to go where the legislative intent is. I just hate when we start making lists of who is who, and so I think noted, well, we want to be specific. Actually writing somebody's name in legislation might not be good legislative process going forward.
Right.
So we'll find the right spot. Mr. Chair, may I move this bill?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 2392 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services provision of the Omnibus Finance Bill.
That's just great. On that, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. The committee is adjourned.